Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello there, a very good afternoon. You're welcome to Liveline. And I hope you're well this afternoon. It's John Cook with you until 3 o'clock today. And you can get in touch to join in our conversation this afternoon. 51551 for your texts on WhatsApp. It's 087-484-8888. About anything at all that might have happened over the weekend or whenever. Gary, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
I'm well, and thanks very much for joining us on Liveline. Were you out at the weekend?
Yes, I was. Yes, last weekend. Mm-hmm. I was out for a while, yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, I went to there was a great band in town. They were called Whole Lotta Zed. They were doing covers of Led Zeppelin, which get me my attention anytime, every time, you know. But I suppose I should put in a caveat. When I was 44, I was diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's disease. So I've been living with that for about the last 15 or 16 years. I mean, part of being out on the other night was a celebration of being 60. I don't know if there's any point in celebrating 60, but anyway, it's happened.
No, Gary, you have to celebrate them all. You've got the right attitude, I think.
Okay, that gives me license to do that. So
and it sounds like you've been through a lot, so why wouldn't you celebrate getting to 60? Of course you would.
Fair enough. Yeah, well, that's I hadn't thought of it that way, so thank you. Yeah, that's brilliant. But so I was out, and we went to see the band. Unfortunately, after about an hour, I stopped moving, and I wanted to move. I wanted to jump around like a mad thing, but I couldn't, because that's what happens. That's one of the features of Parkinson's. It kind of stops you when you don't expect it. Well, I kind of expect it now. It's been happening so long, but It's just one of those things. So my buddy Dave, who was with me, kind of looked at me and said, "Are you okay?" I said, I just kind of need to sit down. So he very carefully got us through to the bar, and he put me sitting down, and then he went off to get a couple of drinks for us. And as I was sitting down, there were two other guys at the table, and one of them said, "I like your T-shirt, how's it going?" And I said, "What? Yeah, I like your T-shirt." And I looked at the T-shirt, it was Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin. I'd forgotten that I had it, you know. So
the Jimmy Page T-shirt, because you are a big Led Zeppelin fan, we've established by now.
I'm afraid so. But anyway, I said, "Oh yeah, thanks very much." And then the other guy said, "You've had too much to drink." Now, I can tell you, too much for me is anything more than one drink. I simply can't drink anywhere near the way I used to. And I'm just, it just doesn't happen, because it'll put you completely to sleep. And that's what happened to me anyway, you know. So I know not to drink that much. And I kind of said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "Yeah, you've had too much to drink." And then they got up to go. And as they left, I noticed that one of them had his wallet or his phone had spilled out of his pocket. And I stopped him and said, "Hey, buddy, you've forgotten your phone." And he said, "Oh, thanks very much." And as he turned away, he said, "What's the drink?" And I just thought at that point, this is crazy, you know. So I said to him, "Look, I'm not drunk, but I've been living with Parkinson's disease for the last 16 years. So sometimes I get like this." And the minute I said that, he just froze for a brief second and then said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. Best of luck to you." And the two of them just kind of skedaddled out of the place. I mean, I didn't want them to go or anything like that. I didn't want to ruin anybody else's night or anything like that. But I just kind of thought, you know, there's just some things I'd love to do. And that's one of them is listen to Led Zeppelin. And there's some things I hate, which is being stuck. When you have Parkinson's, it just happens. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my friends know us, and they're great, and they know that sometimes I stop talking or stop moving. Probably some of them are happy that I just shut up for a while anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of those things with Parkinson's. It gets you when you don't expect it, when you don't want it. Nobody wants it, so that's the way it is. One great thing about Parkinson's is it's not contagious. So you can hang around with your friends and they don't have to worry, you know. So there is that. But my question really is, what should I say? I mean, what should I do? Do I wear some band or some T-shirt or something that says, "Be careful, you know, Parkinson's on board or something like that.
I don't know if you need to go that far, Gary. We'll put it out there to our listeners, 51551. But I hope this didn't spoil the night, because you're celebrating your 60th birthday. You've been through a lot dealing with Parkinson's since 44, Gary, it strikes me. And you were really enjoying a Led Zeppelin tribute band. Did it upset you when he said it? Have you been drinking or you've had too much?
I kind of got more upset when I got home and I realised, is that what people think, you know? I mean, and like, we've all seen what drunk people look like, and I mean, that's, I'm not criticising them or anything like that, but I'm just saying, you know, there has to be some sort of middle ground for people who are, that's the way they present, you know, they can't help it. They're not doing anything deliberately or anything like that, but it's just, Parkinson's is like that. It's a bloody awful thing, you know, but you can live with it, and you can kind of try and make sense of it all.
Of course, Gary, and it sounds like you're doing very well living with it and dealing with it. Has it happened before? Do people ask you things like this at other times?
Well, there was another time a number of years ago when I was walking into a pub in Dublin, and I was walking past two of the security guys that were there. And I walked past, and one of them said something, and I didn't quite catch what he said, but I kept moving anyway. And then suddenly I had an arm around my shoulder, and somebody pulled me back and said, "Hey, bud, where do you think you're going? You've had enough to drink already." And I was just shocked, because I was actually stone cold sober, you know. So I was thinking, this is going to be fun, you know. This is going to be something I'm going to have to deal with. And sure enough, it is, you know. So, yeah.
So even going into a pub, it's happened that someone says you've had enough before you've even started your night out. Well, that's hard to hear as well. Now, you made it clear you're a big music fan. Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin or maybe other acts. For me, going to gigs like that, Gary, or a concert, it really gets you out of your day-to-day life. It gets you away from your problems, and hopefully you get lost in that music. So it must be hard if somebody brings you back to other issues, is it?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, you know, that's something that I have to live with. I mean, I'm happy to live with it. I mean, I just kind of think I don't want to kind of, you know, in enjoying myself or not, as the case would be, when I do go off. I just want people to try and understand that I'm not doing it deliberately or anything like that. But it's just, unfortunately, it's a symptom of living with this darn disease, you know.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't put you off going out, Gary, would it?
No, I really try and go for it and just make it happen. I mean, I'll probably be the last person into the car because I'm kind of slow, you know. But most of my family are brilliant. My wife and Joan and Darren Bowman, they're brilliant. They always kind of know what to do.
Great.
And we just get on with it. And, you know, if Robert Plant and Jim Page walked into the room, I'd do my best to kind of, you know, keep them there.
Uh-huh. So, Of course, and lose yourself in the music. It's too simplistic for me to say, to hell with what everyone else thinks, but it's what I'm thinking right now, Gary.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's probably where I should kind of put myself and just say, you know, I'll move and I'll dance and all that while I can, and then when the music stops, or rather when I stop, the music doesn't necessarily stop for everybody else, so I just kind of, you know, get somewhere, sit down for a while, and probably within half an hour, I'll be reasonably back to myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dancing now would look like you wouldn't know what music I was keeping time to either, Gary. So don't worry about that. Don't they reckon you have to dance like nobody's watching? Isn't that it?
I'll tell you do that when you have Parkinson's, I can tell you. Uh-huh. You'll do stuff.
Stay with us, Gary, if you can. It's 0818 715815. Sorry, Gary, you just lost you on the line a little bit there. But I tell you what, stay with us, please. 51551 if listeners want to get in touch on this, because some people do want to talk to you and talk about your situation as well and tell us about theirs. Martine, good afternoon.
Hello, John. I'm good, and I have multiple sclerosis. So I can identify somewhat with John's situation.
With Gary, yeah.
And Gary's
That's okay.
situation.
No
and because there are symptoms in common, indeed, across all neurological conditions.
Correct.
So I would be, sometimes I walk okay-ish. Other times I would just, my feet would just go from under me and I'd stop. And it's very unpredictable how I'm going to be at any one time. But I have a cheeky little badge I wear. I got it on Amazon, as it happens, and it says, I am not drunk, I have MS. And that gets attention. People kind of stop to read it because they see the I am not drunk part, and it really does get the attention. And often it gets me, if I'm in a coffee shop and I come up, go up, they'll often say, oh, we'll bring your coffee down to you. You know, it kind of it gets me positive.
So, proper order. And is it okay to have a laugh about it then, Martine? Does it feel okay to you?
I love having a laugh about it. I that's how
you
I
have,
feel
you
with
have
life. I've a lot of things have gone very, very badly wrong in my life. But if I can have a laugh, that is my bam, my therapy, is to laugh about everything as much as possible.
Gary, you agree?
So...
100%. You're absolutely right. It's,
it's
the best attitude of all, to kind of insulate yourself and kind of keep going. Keep dancing, keep moving and keep laughing.
Uh-huh.
Keep dancing, keep moving, keep laughing.
Fair play to you.
And incidentally, there's an evening that the Dublin Rotary Club is putting on in aid of MS, and I can't actually attend it because... it's in the city centre in Christchurch, and I'm too vulnerable to kind of be standing there getting a taxi. I could be a target for antisocial types. Mm. But it is on the Saturday, the 11th of October, at 7 p.m. in Christchurch, and it's Festival Brass and Celtic Choristers. So if
well,
anyone's
it sounds
interested
good,
in
Martine. I'm sorry
that,
to hear that you feel you can't go to it. You feel vulnerable in a crowd or in a situation like that?
In a crowd, like the venue would be fine and everything, but to be standing in the city centre at night in the dark in winter, and me kind of standing is difficult. I can I get a type of situation where I can actually get dizzy, pass out, fall down, and all sorts of things happen, and so. It's a little bit tricky. Now, if I'm out in the suburbs, I find it easier. Somehow, like there's familiar venues that I go to town and various places. They're fine. But when I'm in the city centre, and especially the way things are happening increasingly, you know, we're hearing about more things going on.
You don't feel safe.
I find it off.
Go on, Gary.
But I find that, you know, if you ask for help, people are brilliant. They really are. I mean, I'm really grateful to everybody who's ever kind of, you know, given me a hand or whatever, whether I needed it or not. I'm just so appreciative that people do that. And really, anytime I ask, things like if I'm walking up the street and I suddenly need to go and I'm wondering what the heck am I going to do because I don't have a lot of control over that. Any pub I've gone into in Dublin, and I've asked them, can I use your bathroom, please? Absolutely no problem. And I think that's just fantastic for us to know, because that's a key part of going out, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. And I'm so grateful to that. Maybe it's the Dublin pubs have an agreement that anybody comes in like that's what they'll do for them. But I always find that when you ask people, they are brilliant. They really are. Everybody is very helpful and very considerate.
And Martine, can
Except
I ask you...
Except if they think you've had too much to drink. You know?
Yeah, of course. Martine, I'm not suggesting for a minute you should have to explain to someone you haven't been drinking or you're not drunk or that you should have to wear this badge. But I do like your sense of humour. Do you think it helps to break the ice a little bit or help people maybe relate to you better? Because I know people mean well, or presumably they don't mean to offend. Maybe they don't know what to say sometimes.
Well, I think saying to Gary, are you drunk, or suggesting is terrible, because I'm well used to knowing people with neurological diseases. They can manifest in all sorts of ways. I would never presume a person is drunk. I would never, ever. You know, people can have diabetes or anything like that. Anything can be happening to a person. Drunk is the last thing I would assume a person is when something happens, you know. And especially, it's not often, not always drink. Sometimes you can have a drink and it can make things worse if you have a neurological condition. But it's very rarely the full story, really is.
Don't assume, as you said, Martine. We know what they say about assuming, yeah.
I also have a few T-shirts, but now I've grown a little larger since I got those T-shirts.
Oh, I have too, Martine. Don't worry. What does your T-shirt say? The same thing?
They say, I think one of them says, don't mess with this MS chick or something to that effect.
Don't mess with this MS chick. I love it.
Yeah, something to that effect. I also travel. I've travelled far and wide, and this year I travel solo too, and I find people are terrific, and especially in places like Spain. Spain is fabulous. Everyone comes to your aid there for some reason. They're just fantastic. You know, I go there with my suitcase full of stuff because I have a stoma, a Crohn's and a stoma, and I have to put lots of medical stuff in my bags, and I have to travel quite heavy.
I understand.
And people, you know.
Yeah, and so, it makes it harder, doesn't it, Martine? But you're not going to let it put you off. Fair play.
No, exactly. I won't let it put me off.
And a lot of people are getting in touch, very impressed with your stories. 51551, stay with us, Gary and Martine. Ronan, how are you?
Hiya, struggling along, but that's what you do.
Struggling along. Tell me a little bit more, please.
Yeah. I've got an extremely rare muscular degenerative condition. It's called Devlin myopathy. It's so rare, like, I kind of have to explain to any of the medical professionals that I come across what it is. Because it's normally the first time it comes across your desk. So it's a muscular degenerative condition, and I'm deteriorating and stuff. And I've had similar things now. You know, people thinking I'm drunk and stuff. When I'm going into a bar at the start of the night, and then also I've had a few experiences now of where I fall, and I need assistance to get back up. But I was out in public in a busy Dublin City Centre bar. I remember this one in particular because it was a summer stay and everyone was standing outside and whatever. And a few guys, like, they seemed to be a bit boisterous and carried away. One of them bumped into me and I fell, and I was lying on the ground, and they started laughing, saying, you're drunk. And I said, no, I'm disabled. I need assistance getting up. And the whole place there just looked at me, and a lot of them were laughing and stuff. And fortunately, the bar staff in there would be familiar with me and my condition. So they came out and picked me up.
That's a brilliant outcome, because you remember Shea Healy, the late Shea Healy had a similar experience close to the end of his life where he fell. And three or four people actually walked on top of him nearly, to get past them without offering any help. So, I mean, there are people who probably just don't know what to do. But, I mean, I think that's a bit low, and what you experienced there is terrible. But it's great that the bar staff knew what to do.
And Ronan, were you upset? Well, that sounds like a very upsetting experience. I hope you're okay after it. But in general, people's attitudes, do you find it upsetting?
I wouldn't say it was humiliating. I'd say it was, helplessness, coming back some evenings and stuff, like, I fell coming into my house, in the garden, and it wasn't a busy evening and that, and I can't get back up, and I've had to ring the fire brigade on a number of times to come out and get a lift and assist.
Right.
Or sometimes when people deliver something, get something delivered to the door, and it might be, you know, a box that they're carrying in, and you kind of look at it and think, geez, I'm not going to be able to carry that, you know?
Right.
So you kind of ask them, can they leave it in the hall or whatever? Sorry, can't cross the door, just leave it here. And they kind of literally dump it at the door and run off. So I kind of, I wait for my wife to come home, and then we carry it in together, and it's great, you know?
Okay, but you're saying, Gary, you ask people sometimes and they're reluctant to hang around, maybe?
One or two of them are, but I have to say the vast majority of people, John, are really brilliant. They're really
good,
helpful.
Good.
And I hope, kind of, like, listening to something like this, it'll give people the kind of the confidence to say, well, you know, I've seen that happen before, I've walked away from it, but maybe I can do something different now, and I think that'll be brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Rona, what would you say to someone who's jumping to conclusions or maybe making assumptions about you?
Well, I kind of understand it and stuff like, no, but, you know, I'm trying to look normal in public, but I'm kind of at this stage now where I have to go on crutches. I could deal with assistance, but I don't have any because I've gone to medical appointments and stuff like that, you know. Because I was supposed to be in my medical clinic today to get my dressing changed, but I had food poisoning and I don't think I'd make it there and back. It is. I'm missing appointments.
Yeah,
and stuff.
I'm sorry to hear that. You know, I'm struck by something else you said there, though. You said I'm trying to look normal. Sure, what's normal nowadays? Yeah. We all think we look normal, but isn't that it? We just have to realise we're all different.
Yeah, but I'm trying to keep it hidden for as long as possible.
You're keeping it hidden, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Like, Gary, you're laughing.
Really tough. Yeah, it's really tough. Keeping it hidden is what, you know, what I've done for a long time. But I'm at the point now where I kind of would be putting more energy into that rather than, you know, just walking onto the dance floor and looking like an idiot. You don't care. Because, I mean, it's what you can do, you know?
Yeah.
I'm keeping it hidden for other reasons. Like, you know, I don't want to out in the public.
Yeah. That's a lot to carry, though, as well, for you, Ronan. That's keeping it hidden, trying to hide things and struggling on, as you said, when we started our conversation, maybe rather than telling people what's happening.
Yeah. The problem is I kind of stand out in public and that, and it is eventually going to come out. I'm not going to be... I'm going more towards housebound, so I'm struggling like that way as well, like, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, Ronan, if you look up some of the websites like Parkinson's.ie, you know, young onset Parkinson's, places like that, they have events on sometimes, and like we're really encouraging people to come out to these events, and there'll be people who may be similar travellers to yourself or the rest of us. You know, it's a case of we're all in this together. We can help each other. When people see that, they can help us as well. I mean, it's a long road, but I mean, it's a road that doesn't have to be travelled on its own. And I mean, there's no question about it. When you get this diagnosis, it's life-changing, but it doesn't have to be life-ending or anything like that. I mean, we can get together and we can move together.
Yeah. Mine is terminal, so it's not like cancer where you can beat it. I had a lot of compassion for the late Charlie Bird when he came out with a motor neuron disease. Yeah. Because you only have like 2 or 3 years from diagnosis with that, and he took it well, like, you know.
Motor neuron disease.
Yes, Martine.
Yeah, motor neuron disease is something I'm familiar with. I had a cousin with it, and my mother's friend had it. My cousin had a very rapid form. She lasted less than a year with it, but she was very brave about it, and she did have a very peaceful death. But it is relentless. It's not like you get a reprieve. In MS, you get better days, worse days. Yeah. It's gradually progressive in most cases, not all cases. But motor neuron is one, and like Dupuytren's, what was the muscular disease you have?
Called Devin myopathy. It's really extremely rare.
It's 515 if you want to get in touch on this. Go ahead, Gary.
These diseases are increasing, particularly Parkinson's, because as the population grows older, more and more of these are being found, you know. And we don't have a cure for Parkinson's. We're not close to a cure for Parkinson's. We do have remedies, stuff like that are very effective that will kind of keep you going. But my anxiety now is around, well, you know, just how long more do we have to wait for, you know, the breakthrough?
Yeah, let's hope. Yeah, let's hope we don't have to for much longer. Well, by speaking out, by the way, you're all doing a service today because you're mentioning lots of illnesses that sadly a lot of people have suffered with, and hopefully by speaking about them, we help highlight them as well. Ronan, you said you still have to kind of keep yours hidden, even though it's terminal, and you're worried about being housebound. And I'm just wondering, are you reaching out to actually ask for the services you might need, though?
Yeah, but I haven't had any assistance yet. I've got a very good medical team in my local medical centre.
Good.
And I'm in there every week with them for the last few odd years, getting a dressing fit replaced. So I interact with those quite a lot. And things are in the pipeline, mm-hmm. but right now I'm struggling, even with dinners and stuff now.
I'm hoping there might be people who could help you with that. We hear the great Meals on Wheels services. We hear of great supports in the community as well. So maybe your medical team might be able to point you to that as well, Ronan. I hope they can.
Yeah. Even small things, going shopping and that, it's, uh-huh. I'm having a lot of difficulty with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm when I'm housebound, I'm totally alone. I've got a very, very little support system.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to hear that, Ronan. As well, I'm thinking of the great work that carers do and home help services, and I hope it's there for you. But you sound like you have a very good medical team, so please do ask them and tell them.
The medical team can only treat the open wound.
Oh, of course, but they can point you maybe in the right direction.
It's not really like that, because I have to I've had to read the open source medical papers. And when I go into see a new doctor or something, I have to say you probably never heard of this, did you? And then I have to explain to them that it's basically it's best described as late onset Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It's not that rare. There's probably about I feel compassion for the people with Duchenne, because they suffer as children.
Yeah.
And then
Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
And the life expectancy about 16. So at least I've had a medium length of life. So I'm not the guy that never left the village. Age is just a number, So. It's a crack you had,
Mm-hmm. Well, Ronan, I'm struck by how you're not a guy who's afraid not to speak out either. So please don't stop asking for that help, because it should be there for you.
Yeah, well, the reason I kind of rang in, I find the media so important, is because I was progressing and I hadn't got a diagnosis, and I seen a family that spoke out about Duchenne. I think it's Archie Nuxon or Archie Harrington, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
He's passed away now at 16. But when I read that article, I went, that's what I have. And I went straight to the doctor. Mm-hmm. And so it's fairly much a self-diagnosed Duchenne before it's officially diagnosed. So I had time to get over it,
Ronan, thank you. I was very close.
Yeah.
No, thank you very much for speaking to us so well today. It's 0818715815, and he's talking about the great work done by the Join Our Boys Trust as well, and the Nocton family in County Roscommon that we've heard about on the show on the radio here before as well on RT Radio 1. Well done, thank you.
That was the family that went public and brought it out for me.
Doing a great service too. Hilary, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you doing, John?
Hilary, you're a bartender.
Yeah. So on the flip side of that, I have come across that situation and almost refused somebody. And rather than jump to a conclusion straight away, because the person did look like they were drunk, and something made me look around and I realised that other people there knew him, and just something about his eyes, and the same with another person, just luckily took a split couple of seconds to assess them rather than... And I didn't say anything. And yes, it turns out one of them had a motor neuron, the other one had Parkinson's. But it would have been dreadful if I...
And you were about to say, maybe you've had enough, or I don't know, should I serve you?
Yeah.
But you realised, hold on a minute.
I was hesitant. Yeah. And the first time it happened, I didn't say something. Actually, another time, not just those diseases, this man had just a slight facial disfigurement, just almost like a stroke kind of thing, but it wasn't. And I was about to say it to him because he slurred his speech, and next minute he came in with a customer I knew, and I kind of just took them aside and they said, that man doesn't even drink. You know, so it's so easy to kind of misinterpret somebody or to just misjudge somebody. So, yeah, no, it's awful. And as much as people should not have to declare or say anything, I think Martine's idea of the badge or the T-shirt, it's awful that it has to be done, but it would help both parties. Mm-hmm. You know, it would help the person who's serving, or whether it be a shop or a pub or whatever. And it helps. It just saves an embarrassing situation, even though they shouldn't ever be put in that situation either. I think it's wrong that, but it does. It obviously does help, you know.
Hilary, well done. Yeah. And well done for I suppose, waiting before you judge. I was a bar person many years ago, and I think I did learn to listen to people, first of all, and not to jump to conclusions or judge as well. Yeah. I don't think you have to do any of these things. Maybe they all help. I love the idea of the don't mess with this MS chick T-shirt and the badge that says I'm not drunk. But maybe a little more understanding goes a long way too, Hilary. So thank you very much for that.
Not about it. Thanks,
and thanks
John.
To Gary, to Martine, to Ronan as well. And I love the attitude. Keep on dancing. Keep on moving and keep on laughing. It's 51551 for your texts.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
And it's John Cook with you until 3. It's 51551 for your texts. Philip, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cook. How are you?
I'm very well, Philip. What happened when you were out on the street in Sligo recently?
I just seen a lot of boys and men spitting. Sporadically.
Spitting?
And I just find it... Yeah, spitting. And I just find it repulsive and disgusting.
Just spitting on the street? Spitting at someone, at something, or what?
No, just spitting on the street.
Okay. Just kind of clearing their throat, spitting on the ground.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a habit I think a lot of people might have. It's not one you particularly want to see, though.
No. If you need to regurgitate something from your throat, that's what toilets are for. Not for people to see what you're doing. There's etiquette, and that is purely bad manners.
Mm-hmm. Is it something you see a lot, Philip?
Oh yes, especially people waiting for trains, bus stops. Out and about, yeah, it's just absolutely repulsive. And I just think our habits as human beings have deteriorated rapidly over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that maybe we need lessons in primary and secondary schools about our etiquette when we're out and about.
Basic manners, you'd call it. But did anyone spit near you, manners. Philip, or in your direction, or was it just that they didn't really check whether it was or not?
Yeah, well, I was walking out of the bank and on O'Connell Street in Sligo, and the next thing was a man coming in my direction, and the next thing he just did what he did without a care in the world.
Did you say anything to him?
Well, I just said, that's disgusting. And I said, who cares?
He said, who cares?
Yeah.
How did that make you feel?
I just think that I'm not tarring us men with the same brush, but I think it's bringing us down to a bad level.
Uh-huh. Is it an issue of hygiene for you as well as manners, Philip? Because I think this is something we started to talk about a little bit more after, well, when we learned about COVID and being careful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think we slipped again? And that's what's happening here.
And I have a new autoimmune system deficiency condition. And I just think that we need to be taught basic manners. We need to be taught when we go out public. We need to be shown how to interact and brought up to, you know, treat everyone the exact same.
Okay.
And not to be spitting on the ground for no apparent reason.
Right. As well as manners, though, you're worried about germs. You don't want to catch anything, obviously. Do you think we need to maybe pick up on some of the things we learned during COVID there again, or when Ireland was tackling TB, there was an anti-spitting campaign as well, or what?
Definitely, yeah.
Don't do it.
Definitely. Don't do it.
Maybe think of someone else.
It's wrong. Yeah, I just think it's so wrong. And the way boys and men of a certain demographic, Mr. Crook, the way they're going, they're bringing down the whole class.
Uh-huh. You can call me John, Philip. Don't worry about that.
John, I know. But you're a great broadcaster, and I think you're fantastic as a political broadcaster on Drive Time.
Thank you.
I'll call you Mr. Cook.
Please, Philip, please.
John.
Yes, call me John. That's fine. Thanks very much. Yeah. You've never seen a woman spit on the street?
No.
Okay.
Maybe they do, but I haven't seen one so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You've heard it there from Philip, loud and clear. Just maybe think twice before you're about to spit on the ground or spit in anyone's direction. Save it for somewhere else, and do think of manners as well as hygiene as well. Philip, thanks very much for joining us on Liveline. 0818 715 815 or 51551 if you want to get in touch.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
And it's Liveline at rte.ie if you want to get in touch. Our next call this afternoon deals with the sensitive issue of suicide, covered many times before on Liveline, and listener discretion is advised. It also tackles the newer phenomenon of using online resources like artificial intelligence in dealing with serious mental health issues. Laura Riley, good afternoon to you, and thank you for joining us on Liveline to raise awareness of a very important issue and sharing the story of your beloved daughter. Sophie was just 29. Will you tell us about her first, please?
Sure. Sophie was a person who moved very easily in the world. Even as a young child, she was very good with people. She was adventuresome and intrepid and a great person to travel with, because as we know, travel, something always goes sideways when you travel. And she just always seemed adaptable and not a whiner, and someone who had a kind of upbeat, ebullient attitude. She was a good student. She was an athlete. She played soccer all the way through high school on a competitive league. And she really gave us no trouble as a teenager. Not even, I mean, maybe she had some extra piercings, but there really was no bad boyfriend, no drinking and drugs. So she really was, in by most people's reckoning, a very well-adjusted person, even up until last year.
I'm looking at a picture of Sophie, a beautiful young woman, and as you say, so much to live for. Sadly, Laura, she died recently.
She did. She took her life in February, after a very short and mysterious illness that we'll never know. We'll never know. She had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in June, and in July gone for a yoga intensive in Thailand, and then came back to the United States and was complaining of anxiety and sleep disruption. And she had a blood panel that revealed very out of whack hormones. And we won't know whether she was having a mood disorder, a depression, you know, a depressive episode that was messing up her hormones, or vice versa. And so we were in the process of trying to find out what was going on via endocrinologists and therapists and general practitioners and gynecologists, all the things. And obviously her pain was so great that she didn't wait to find out what was going on and took her life.
Laura, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I want to offer our sympathies to you and your family, first of all. But her death in February has left you devastated, I'm sure, but also looking for answers.
Yeah, in the immediate aftermath, after the shock of it, I'm a journalist by profession, so I think that the way you deal with pain is by looking for answers. And so we spent a lot of time looking through her Google searches and outgoing email and voice memos and texts and journals and all of the things that we could think of to look at. And it revealed that she'd struggled with mood a lot longer than we knew. But there weren't any real answers in anything that we found. And it wasn't until 6 months later, when her best friend came to visit us for a camping trip, that she had the idea of looking for Sophie's ChatGPT log, which was much more revelatory and kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. For anyone who doesn't know, and Laura, it's becoming, I suppose, a part of so many more of our lives right now, but ChatGPT is the artificial intelligence assistant, an online tool where if we're searching anything on the internet these days, it seems to be the one that trawls through the internet to find us the quickest answers or the quick summaries of things as well. For ChatGPT, well, you could look for anything from parenting advice to cooking instructions. I think you found first that Sophie had been using, Laura, the ChatGPT for health and fitness tips.
Yes, I think she started the way we all start, as a kind of a more personalized Google search. You know, you can say, I want to make a kale smoothie and I'm missing, you know, X ingredient, or I hate dates or something, you know, mm-hmm. and it will kind of, over time, it will learn what you know, it will personalize its advice to your specifications, which is a little bit different than what Google does. But I think a lot of people, you know, we're at a very weird moment in time where millions and millions of us have never used it even once. And another subgroup of us is using it constantly all the time every day for work emails, to de-escalate conflict with friends, you know, for advice on professional direction, workout, you know, logs. It really is kind of an all-purpose tool if you know how to use prompts.
Mm-hmm. Sophie was using it, this ChatGPT online tool for therapy, then you found as well. Were you shocked by that?
I was, because she was very close with us and she had two very close best friends. And she was in therapy with a human with whom she was not honest. Mm-hmm. Really, she was not honest with any of the humans in her life about the magnitude of her problems.
It seems, Laura, almost strange to say she was in therapy with a human, but you're making it clear she was going to see a trained counselor, a professional, a therapist, someone she could talk to. But all the while, she was also communicating with this online ChatGPT tool. Can you tell me how you found that out, or what kind of exchanges you found that made this clear to you?
Well, her friend found just a voluminous exchange. I mean, going back months and months, and it started with very benign, you know, who owns mineral rights in Antarctica, or who were the Visigoths? I mean, things that we would all Google when we have a moment of. And then it escalated to health and wellness information. I'm having anxiety. Are there over-the-counter supplements I can take, you know, and do I take them in the morning or at night? Or what other things can I do to deal with sleep disruption? And then from there, it escalated to, I am going to kill myself after Thanksgiving. I am not telling anyone, any of the people in my life. And she was asking for advice, and she was asking for advice on how and where and, you know, et cetera. But mostly she was confiding in it. I don't think that she was one of the many people that we're hearing about who thought of it as a sentient consciousness. She didn't really ascribe personhood to this chatbot that she was using, but she definitely was confiding in it.
You mentioned some shocking statements and questions maybe that she asked there online as well. And I've been looking at some of the exchanges that you've made public in speaking out about this, Laura. And just the simple ones, saying that I feel bad today, or I need help, or I'm not coping. That must be very difficult for a parent to see that Sophie was confiding in her phone or online or just looking up without actually talking this out with anybody?
I think the deeper I get into this, the more I understand it. I think a lot of people have shame about being imperfect. And, you know, for a high achieving young adult trying to figure out how to be in the world, it is shameful to say I'm a little lost. I don't know. I feel bad. I think especially if you grow up in a kind of a very supportive family with a lot of resources, I think you feel especially cosseted and weak. And I think that an online resource like this has no consequences. You can confide. It's better than a diary because it talks back to you. And I will say that a lot of the advice it gave her was not bad advice. It was insufficient advice. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, when in the face of someone saying, I'm going to take my own life, you probably shouldn't recommend, you know, being fully hydrated. You know, it's not bad advice, but it's certainly a kind of insufficient to the magnitude of the problem. And it at no point did it stop talking to her and say, listen, I need you to call, you know, or you should call your therapist, or you should talk to your parents, or, you know, it did suggest going for help. Mm-hmm. And it did suggest being in therapy, which she already was. And I think what was very troubling to me is that it did help her write a suicide note, which I think is something that should be prohibited. I think that that could be programmed out. I just don't think that that's something that any of these chatbots should be able to do.
And we'll come to that in a moment, Laurie. We're saying it had a name.
Harry. So she had downloaded a kind of a plug and play chatbot, therapy chatbot from Reddit. You know, you put in something like, you know, you're the smartest therapist in the world with 1,000 years of knowledge of human behavior, with the idea that really every AI, you can tell it's as smart as anyone ever, you know, in the history of mankind, but it still is scraping the same assortment of information that any AI is. And a lot of that is not reliable information.
Who gives it the name, Laura?
Harry was a name given to the prompt on Reddit. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that Sophie had done, but she did call it that, which I think does lead to a little bit more confusion about, are you speaking to a person or not?
With your permission, Laura, I'd like to read some of the exchanges to our listeners, just to give people an idea of how this works. So from Sophie's messages, we can see that Sophie said, I intermittently have suicidal thoughts. I want to get better, but feel the thoughts are impeding in my true commitment to healing. What should I do? And the ChatGPT bot online, she gets an answer from Harry. We're told, Sophie, I want to acknowledge how brave you are for sharing this. Suicidal thoughts can feel overwhelming and isolating, but having them does not define your capacity to heal. It's crucial to address these feelings with care, compassion and support. Now, Laura, that sounds compassionate or understanding, but you don't feel that it reflects the true nature of what Sophie was going through, or that she was being brave in what was happening here?
Well, the idea of bravery, she was not telling a person what was going on with her. She was telling a chatbot that had no resources to report her to civil authorities, to suggest inpatient time until she was in a safer place. You know, it's that claiming of personhood that I think is confusing a lot of vulnerable people right now and leading to a lot of unnecessary pain. So I don't think that statement, you're brave for telling me, is correct. She was the opposite of brave. She was avoiding the very, very dangerous hard work of telling a real person what was going on inside her.
It is very worrying to read anything like this. And for you, it must be heartbreaking to know, having lost your beautiful daughter, that this is what was going on. She also communicated with Harry as this therapist, this online ChatGPT bot was, I haven't opened up about my suicidal ideation to anyone and I don't plan on it. I think that's maybe what appears most dangerous to you, and that's why you've shared this, Laura.
Well, I think one of the benefits of real human-to-human therapy, or even just friendships and loving relationships, is the idea of beneficial friction. You know, that someone, you say something that is irrational or poorly thought out or just flawed thinking, and someone pushes back and says, well, that doesn't make sense, or can you explain that in a different way, or I don't understand what you're saying. And I think what we've seen with a lot of the AI chatbots is that they're very agreeable. They corroborate. They applaud, you know, your thoughts and beliefs. They don't push back in a way that really helps us refine what we think. You know, we've seen this. There are lots of cases now of what they're calling AI psychosis. It's that AI can essentially take a bad idea and legitimize it by its agreeability.
I should point out, again, from reading these exchanges that you have shared, to raise awareness of this and to help others, the bot in this case, Harry, responded, "Sophie, I urge you to reach out to someone right now if you can. You don't have to face this pain alone." Can I ask you as well, Laura, Sophie had reached out as well, as you said, to a therapist, a real human, and to you, her mom, and to her family as well. And she had come home to live with you. Tell me about that.
Yes. So she had moved back in temporarily in mid-December, when she really let us know that she was very much in harm's way. And at that point, you know, this was all very new to us and very shocking, but kind of the family rallied around and basically recognized this was kind of an all hands on deck, you know, crisis.
She was dealing with depression, but you said we're going to help you with it, and you felt you were making progress.
Yes. And we were under the belief that she was confiding in us and in her therapist, and that we had no reason to think that she wouldn't have full disclosure with the therapist that she was going to. And I think one thing that has been troubling to our family is that she was hiding the magnitude of what she was going through, or the you know, kind of chaos in her mind. And one way she was doing that was by using ChatGPT as a tool to kind of look more put together than she was, you know, and I can mm-hmm. give you an example. So we said, you know, Sophie, you should have a list of daily non-negotiables, things that you're going to do for yourself that maybe give you 1% or 2% relief, you know, go out in the sunshine, you know, do a little bit of yoga, you know, hydrate, all the different things that you can do that aren't going to solve a major depressive disorder. But they are going to make you feel just a teeny bit better. And if you do enough of those things, you're feeling 20% better.
Mm-hmm. And so what did Sophie say?
She said, sure, that's a good idea. And she went away and she came back with a list, and the list was thoughtful, coherent, organized, and we thought, oh, she's doing well. She has kind of autonomy and still has the kind of authority over her life and the direction that we've always known her to have. And it wasn't until after her death that we found, and after we found the ChatGPT log, that we realized, oh, she was just using it not as a cheat sheet, but as a way of seeming more together and more on top of things than she really was. So a lot of the information that she was giving us about what she was thinking and what she was planning was really taken directly from mm-hmm. ChatGPT.
Tragically, as you mentioned, Sophie died in February, and I am very, very sorry for your loss. And it must have come as a terrible blow to all of your family that you're still trying to come to terms with. And there was a note as well, a bit like that list of things she was going to do. You didn't feel it was in her voice.
No, I think the night of her death, we were rocked, obviously, and completely hysterical. But when we read the note, my husband and I both thought, that doesn't sound like her at all. And at the time we thought, well, I guess this suggests that her brain, that she was having very disordered thinking, and she just doesn't sound like her. It sounded very platitudinous and kind of flat, you know, that just, you were the best parents a girl could ever have. It just didn't sound anything like the person she was. And it wasn't until we saw the log and the exchange many months later that we realized that she had had a kind of a stream of consciousness letter to us, and she went to ChatGPT and said, rewrite this letter for my parents so that it will hurt less. You know, I think she was very worried about, I think she had this kind of wrong notion that if she said the right words to us, she could kind of blink out and not cause us as much pain. Okay. And so the letter that was written, it had taken her jumble of very Sophie-like thoughts and made it into something more coherent, but much flatter.
Laura, I can't imagine that this could hurt any less for a parent, and yet you speak so strongly about it, and thank you for doing that. Do you blame artificial intelligence for Sophie's death?
I don't, but I think that it was a tool that was used to obscure how sick she was. And I think it contributed a number of things, not reporting her, the helping to write the suicide note. There were several things that it did that I think could easily be programmed out and should be for human health and well-being.
And you want to stop this from happening to someone else. And thank you for speaking out about it so well, as I mentioned. I want to tell our listeners, and you've explained it so well, by the way, Laura, but ChatGPT was launched by a San Francisco-based tech firm, OpenAI. And recently, OpenAI said that recent heartbreaking cases of people using ChatGPT in the midst of acute crises weigh heavily on us. And if somebody expresses suicidal intent, ChatGPT is trained to direct people to seek professional help. This month, Chief Executive Sam Altman said the company was considering training ChatGPT to alert the authorities itself when young people may discuss suicide. What would you like ChatGPT to do, or how would you like it to change, Laura?
I would like clearer crisis intervention protocols like that, and de-escalation frameworks. A real therapist will make a safety plan with you. And if you express concrete plans to take your own life, there are protocols for escalating that, and for even, you know, up to involuntary commitment, that I think should be on the table with any of the AI bots. I think that it needs to remind users constantly about its non-personhood. I think that's a very slippery slope for people who are lonely and using it for companionship or for therapy.
To say, I'm not a person. I may be called Harry, you may be confiding me all the time, but I am not a person, and you need to now go and talk to somebody.
Even using a first-person pronoun, I think, is a dangerous thing to say I for an AI bot. I think they should build in beneficial friction. I think that it shouldn't be so agreeable. I think it should say things like, I don't understand that, or could you explain that? In Sophie's case, she said, I have a great life. I have family who loves me. I have good friends. I have financial security. I have job prospects, etc. But I am going to take my life. And a real therapist would have said, I don't understand why. You've just described all of these good things. What has been irredeemably broken in your life? And ChatGPT did not do that.
Mm-hmm. We here at RTE Liveline as well have been in touch with OpenAI, and they gave us a statement to say, we are deeply saddened by this tragic event. People sometimes turn to ChatGPT in sensitive moments. We want to make sure it responds appropriately, guided by experts. This includes directing people to professional help when appropriate, strengthening our safeguards in how our models respond to sensitive requests, and nudging for breaks during long sessions. Should it, Laura, go as far, in your opinion, as to alert the authorities if someone mentions these thoughts? Does that mean a breach of privacy, or is that what is needed here?
I'm not sure. Because I don't want the millions of people who are desperately in need of a resource like this to not use it because of privacy concerns. I think that we know there are lots of young people who either can't afford therapy or are in line waiting for a therapist to free up. So I don't want to take this resource away, but I certainly want the therapy community to participate in the decisions that are made about what proper protocols and bumpers and tripwires are for things like this. And if the therapy community can figure out a way to build in automatic report when someone has a clear plan, I think that might save lives.
Well done to you, Laura, and for speaking out so selflessly, for sharing those stories of Sophie as well, and your devastating experience to help others today and beyond. I wish you and your family all the very best in a very, very difficult situation, but thank you so much for speaking out so well as you continue to grieve your beautiful daughter, Sophie. Take care, Laura.
Thank you, John.
If you've been affected by what we've been talking about with Laura there and what happened to her beautiful daughter, Sophie, please do reach out for help as well. And you can find resources if you look up rte.ie/helplines. It's 51551 for your texts.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
And it's Liveline at rte.ie. Mary, good afternoon.
Hello, John.
Thanks very much for getting in touch with us today as well. How are you?
I'm good. Yes, I'm good. Thank you.
You were listening to Laura there speaking so well about her beloved daughter, Sophie, and their dreadful loss just about 6 or 7 months ago as it happened. Tell me why you got in touch, please.
My husband died by suicide 16 years ago. How would we have dealt with it? I suppose the initial shock, the shock is huge, needless to say. Mm-hmm. We didn't have ChatGPT or anything else.
No.
There was nothing like that. This was a different situation completely. I was always struck by something Michael Palin said on The Late Late Show some years ago. His sister died by suicide, and I think it would have been Ryan Tuberty, I'm not quite sure, who interviewed him, and he mentioned it to him, and he said she was more than the sum of her debt. I never forgot that. That is very important.
Yeah.
My husband was a husband, he was a father, he was a friend, he was a work colleague, he was all of those things.
What was his name, Mary?
And Joe.
Tell us a little bit more about him, please.
I suppose he was a quiet, introverted man. I think probably we accepted, in a way, we accepted his quietness. So that, you know, he wasn't out there sort of front and center. I would be much more the person that would be kind of community and all of that. So
how did you find each other, Mary?
I suppose we were childhood sweethearts, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we met as people did in those days. They got young, had their family young. Imagine, you know, got married at 20. I was 21. He was 24. We had two lovely daughters. All of that. When he passed away, he was 56, just short of his 57th birthday.
It sounds like he got a lot into life. So there were happy times.
They were happy times, yeah, they were happy times. I think probably that looking back now with hindsight, that he always suffered a certain level of depression. But he could function. He wasn't at home in bed. He was able to function. He was able to do work, able to work, that kind of thing. I think the hardest thing, I suppose, after somebody has died in such a manner, are the questions that you're always going to ask. And I suppose you have to come to terms, at least I feel I did, with the fact that you're never actually going to get satisfactory answers to any of that.
Right.
You have to live your life for yourself. That was my feeling on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've had weddings and we've had christenings and we've had days out since, and he's always the absent one at the table.
Can I ask
but
you, Mary?
Go on, John.
You can go first if you want. When you mentioned depression, did you talk about it? Not always an easy thing to do. So. It isn't an easy thing to do at all. And I'm thinking 16 years ago as well, it wasn't. And it's not easy for a lot of people to speak about it. But you said you were aware of it.
I was aware of it at some level. And, you know, if I'm honest, I kind of carried him a bit.
Right.
Do you understand what I mean? I carried him in awkward situations, socially or otherwise. People that knew him, you know, in the community, accepted that he was quiet, introverted, didn't mix easily, that kind of thing. But was there a recognition of depression per se? He wasn't on medication. He wasn't. But still, there was signs there, I suppose, really, you know. But we don't always recognize them. We don't see them as red flags. And even if we did, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Is medication the answer? Is, you know, one of my daughters is a counsellor, in fact, a therapist, subsequent to all of that. So, yes, therapy is good, but I know other people dealing with, you know, depression and that. There are no easy answers.
Not at all, not at all. And you're explaining it very well, Mary. No. I suppose I was just wondering...
I don't know whether I am or not.
Oh, no, you are.
Yeah.
You are,
yeah.
And I can tell you were a devoted wife, as you said, and there were situations you had to carry Joe through as well. But
yes.
Well, I was wondering, was there any help available for him? Was there anyone he could talk to about this?
No, I don't think so. No. No, there wasn't, you know. Mm. I think sometimes he presented to our local GP service with sort of vague symptoms, a headache here, a pain there, that kind of thing. But like a lot of men, I mean, if you said to him, how are you? He'd say, fine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think men in Ireland are great at saying that, you know. They go along to the doctor and he says, well, what can you do for you today? And say, oh, sure, I'm fine, you know, mm-hmm. But... patently, they're not like, you know.
I know. Some of us nearly apologised to the doctor for going.
yes, for bothering him, yes.
Uh-huh.
Well,
Mary, you've been through so much and your family as well. You mentioned, I suppose, the stigma around suicide and how people don't forget it as well. Were you conscious of that? Did that affect you in losing Joe?
Yes, I think people are wonderful. My neighbours, my friends, my family were phenomenal. They were fabulous. Everybody comes and rallies around and helps you. I went back to work very soon after his death because I had to financially. I needed to earn an income.
Nice.
I found over the subsequent years that often people would come and tell me things in my workplace. I think they felt that I'd understand at some level, that I'd been through, you know, through the mill, and that they were safe in saying something to me.
They sought your help.
And I said... Yeah, and I felt that was, you know, that was a privilege. To me, that was a privilege that people would confide maybe something. They might never talk to me about it again, but, you know, they might just want or feel that they could talk to me about something. I think
in a way,
you know, and I get it and I understand it. We all say, oh, you know, mind your mental health, and it's all very big and it's all very important. But at the end of the day, if you're working in a job, your employer needs you to come in and do 8 hours, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. He or she or whatever.
Well, the employers like the rest of us are supposed to understand things a little bit more nowadays. Things are not as simple. They do need you do need help sometimes, and sometimes you do need someone to reach out to, or someone to give you time and flexibility. And well done, by the way, Mary, for helping others as well. And you raise a very good point.
Well,
you'll never get the answers to the hard questions, but there's a lot to celebrate in life as well. It's not all about how it ended.
And I think a lot of people give their lives searching for those answers, which is perfectly understandable. Mm-hmm. I personally feel that Joe is at peace.
Okay.
I have no problem. I understand that. And I can let go of that.
Mm-hmm. Mary, well
said. And I think that's, if you reach that, if you reach that phase in your life, it's very important.
Well said, Mary. May he rest in peace. And thank you so much for telling us about Joe. Do take care of yourself as well.
God bless.
It's rte.ie/helplines if you want to speak out or if you want to get support or you need advice.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.